Hello, everyone. We're live with SCI TV. I am Anna Gafanova, a practitioner with the Sports Conflict Institute, and I'm joined today by my exemplary professor from the University of Southern California, Dr. Mona Farid-Nirjad. Dr. F, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
It's such a pleasure to have you today. I would love to just learn more a little bit about your background, and if you could tell us, about your career in the organizational space, as well as leadership and group dynamics.
So my career in the organizational space involves kind of wearing two different hats. I'm an academic practitioner. So on the one side, I teach organizational psychology to master's students at the University of Southern California. It is so fun working with students, especially graduate students. They're absolutely brilliant, and I feel like I learn from them every day. For those of you who don't know, like Anna mentioned, she's one of our alums, and we get to have really rich, wonderful discussions in class that just really help us to apply what we're learning and build future leaders for tomorrow, especially people leaders. And then on the other side of my work, I actually run a consulting firm called UpLabs, where we specialize in company culture and change management work that can take a lot of forms depending on the organization. But our ultimate goal is to really help people to thrive through work, not just survive the day to day. And that comes through in a lot of the work that we do on a day-to-day basis.
Sounds super interesting. Thank you. So, in your experience working both in the academia side as well as the professional landscape, what happens when issues stay unspoken, and how can leaders shift the culture to, treat conflict as useful information rather than disruption?
I think it's really the mindset you bring to it at first and foremost. It's you can choose to see conflict as a problem, or you can choose to see conflict as a way to get clarity. And when we avoid conflict or when challenges come up, when we avoid them, it can cause us to stay in a state where our needs aren't being met, which can ultimately lead to things like resentment. People can sometimes shut down as a result of that resentment, stop communicating, which can damage performance, et cetera. But when we embrace conflict, we can kind of get through it. And that's not to say that we should embrace every conflict. Some conflicts are actually kind of worth not mentioning. So, in the event, let's say it's something that's really not that important to you or to other people, it can be easy to just let it fly. Like if it's a decision about, what everyone's going to eat for lunch, it's probably not the end of the world if you let that particular conflict fly. Also, sometimes you don't want to bring up conflict if you're in a place where, even if you were to bring it up, you've had multiple instances in the past where you're certain nothing's going to change. It may not be worth damaging goodwill bringing up the conflict. But there is another side of it where, you bring up the conflict, you keep it task focused. We never attack the person or their character. We keep it on task and we think about how we can do things better and really approach it from a collaborative, curious lens. And who knows, you could actually resolve the conflict and come up with an even better solution than even you thought possible.
Super interesting. Do you think that some of the organizational conflict mimics some of the personal conflicts that we could have between families or partners or friends?
Absolutely. So much of the work that I actually bring into organizational psychology is based in what we know about individuals, even romantic relationships sometimes. And really, I mean, people are people in most contexts. And of course, you need to shift the way you approach certain things like conflict a little from context to context, but really the foundation is quite similar.
Another very point that I'm very curious about is when organizations or families, sometimes they're different dynamics. So some voices carry more than other voices. How do you manage that? How do you create groups that, despite different hierarchy, voices still get heard?
One of the best things one of my professors in grad school actually did that I absolutely loved was at the start of each class, it was a small seminar, and he wanted everyone to participate, but he didn't want anyone to overshare or, talk everyone out of the room. So what he'd do is he'd give everyone like three little slips of paper, and everyone had to use them. And once you used all three, you couldn't share anymore, but everyone had to use all three. And it was just this really simple way to democratize the space and ensure that everyone got an opportunity to contribute, but no one shared too much and took up too much airspace. And it's a simple solution, but it was an effective one. And also, as a manager, it really is your role to be an advocate for people on the team. Not everybody wants to be called out, but also, it is your job to kind of sometimes rein in people who are maybe taking up too much airspace and call in people who you know have something meaningful to contribute, but who maybe don't get a chance to share or who aren't going to be the ones to assertively jump in and share what they have to. So it's really you're a facilitator in many ways as a manager, as a leader. So being able to balance the space, call in people, and create an opportunity for equal sharing and strong decision making. Is really a huge part of your role. And I don't think a lot of managers realize that.
Oh no, I love that. I think this is such a practical tool that more people should use. I've never heard about that, but I think moving forward, I'll implement that with my team too. Echoing on that and some of the work that we do in the sports space, with your background and what are some of your recommendations for building a successful sports team, given that, people have different cultural backgrounds, different professional backgrounds. A lot of the, sports teams have different nationalities, and inevitably, some of the most successful teams, they bring top talent, and that top, like the top talent, they want to have their voices heard. And that's where, a lot of like ego comes into place and, doing things the wrong way. How can the coach and the leadership team really build something successful within a sports organization?
Oh, there's so much to pull from here. So much interesting research in this space. So, first off, one of the things that I would say is most important is having teams that are the appropriate size for the task that needs to be accomplished. When teams are too small, you can overwork people. When teams are too large, they can become overwhelming and difficult to communicate and keep. And kind of structure the path forward. So I would say really think through like how many people do we need? Then think about the team composition. What are the unique skills that your team needs? And being really intentional, and I know it can be tempting to try to move really quickly because you need to fill a role, but really taking your time, being clear on what it is that you need, where the gaps are in your team can be so valuable. And then really searching for someone who meets those particular needs. Third, Adam Grant had, he has a pod on one of his podcasts. He talks about how maybe instead of hiring for all stars, we should hire for team players. And he follows around this athlete that is not maybe the best athlete ever, but every team that this athlete has ever been on has been very successful. And the reason for that is not necessarily because he's an all-star, it's because he's an excellent team player. And so, I think we oftentimes are like, no, we need the best of the best. But sometimes when we get people who are willing to learn, willing to work really effectively with others, that talent can be built and can really be leveraged in remarkable ways. And then once you get people on the team, to your kind of your question about the diversity that a lot of these teams build, is embrace it. Don't bring people onto a team and expect them to behave like the protocol. Bring people on and challenge them to bring forth what makes them unique and interesting, what skills they can leverage, what strengths they have, and create a safe enough space where, they can work through these things together, where they can challenge one another in positive task-oriented ways. And there will, it's like the more diverse teams will be more challenging to manage because they're, by their very nature, may not be on the same page about a lot of things. But if you can leverage those differences as opposed to trying to tamp them down, and make it productive, you actually could end up with some of the most innovative and interesting teams of really anyone.
Absolutely. Do you reckon that those frameworks should be implemented regardless of age? So if we're looking at youth sports, right, and youth competition, there's a lot of, also power dynamics there and group dynamics that need to be focused on, and then looking at adults as well as corporate. Or would you recommend that kids, until they, turn up age, sort of figure it out on their own?
It's a little different from age to age. I usually speaking, children need more structure because and what can actually be really great in that space is giving them a sense of bounded structure where they're given options, like a limited range of options, two or three, and then they can choose what they feel would be best. Because in doing that, you're giving them structure, but you're also giving them opportunities to exercise their autonomy, which can help them to feel more engaged, which can help them to develop self-efficacy or confidence in their ability to solve problems, and ultimately help them to be better players down the road and to bring in more unique and novel ideas.
Interesting. And talk echoing on the confidence part, and trust inevitably. So when a conflict does happen within a team or an organization, what are some of the methods that you prefer to use in your career or recommend of rebuilding trust after a crisis?
I don't know if there's this great quote that I love. It says, "Trust is earned in drops and lost in buckets." And it's true. Like when we can have such a great relationship and all of a sudden something happens, we breach trust and it can be really difficult to redeem. But that doesn't mean that it's hopeless. I would say your best course of action is before it even gets to that point, is aiming to build goodwill. And this is actually one that this is actually one of those theories that kind of translates across multiple domains. So it started in the positive psychology research, finding that we need about 4 to 5 positive interactions for every one negative one. And one of the things that we have found to be the case is if we are actively contributing to goodwill in our teams and amongst our team members, even when we mess up, because we will, everyone does, our team members will know our intentions and they'll know we're not out to get them. And as a result of that, they're a little bit more willing to let the small things slide when we do inevitably mess up, because we will. I would say taking that a step further, if we really want to rebuild trust, it's also a matter of engaging with humility and accountability. Showing up, admitting what we've done wrong, sharing a course of action that we're going to take moving forward, and then really following through on what we say we're going to do. And last but not least, I am inspired by Tony Hsieh, the late Tony Hsieh, former CEO of Zappos. One of the things that he did was when there was an economic downturn. And he communicated very clearly, like, hey, this is going to be a really difficult thing. We don't want people to get laid off. So, what we are going to do is we're going to temporarily reduce everyone's pay so that we can keep everyone. And I'm going to reduce my pay too. And as a result of that, and Tony always kept lower pay in general than most CEOs. And what that demonstrates is like, I'm in the trenches with you. I'm not just like sitting up here on my high horse, totally divorced from your experience. I'm in it with you. We're going to get through this together. And that sense of shared camaraderie and really being in the trenches with your team can mean so much to people.
Wow, this is truly fascinating. I was also watching a podcast yesterday, and I think being proactive, as you said, sending out an email and informing your teammates about what's going to happen or what could happen and how you're going to work through it is so much better than even if you don't have all the information, right? If you, even if you don't know exactly how it's going to turn out, being proactive and notifying your team ahead of time so you can figure out together, I think is a lot better than waiting for all the information to come through and then having people, feel like they've been left out or weren't communicated to on time. And the podcast was discussing some of the COVID-19 measures that different, presidents and vice presidents implemented. And there was one particular example where Australia implemented their COVID-19 protocol before they had any information about the severity. And it saved so many lives because they were proactive. They wrote out a big statement saying, "We're not sure how the severity of the situation, and we're currently giving it a level 2, but please do X, Y, and Z." And then in 2 days, it went to level 5, but people were already aware and they were prepared. So I think this perfectly echoes to, not having all the answers, and that's okay, but keeping everyone in the loop. And yeah, as you said, being in the trenches with your team is important.
Couldn't agree more.
So, looking at some of the research on the academic side, what are the some of the more fascinating maybe developments that you've come across recently, or some of the topics that your students are currently working on that have, brought attention and are, particularly interesting to discuss right now?
A lot of there's still a lot of remote work versus, in person versus hybrid. That's something people are still so curious about, especially as organizations really start to bring people back into the workplace. If I were to be quick about it and get to the key point, hybrid seems to be the way to go, with a lot of very intentional work being done to keep people connected, regardless of where they are. Especially when, even when you're working in sports, you're not always together in the same place. And being really intentional about creating connection, communicating, all of that can be really valuable, even in that space. There are so many studies that I go through on a day-to-day basis. Not all of them are even coming to mind right now. Make sure that people are resting. We had a student who just did a study on PTO usage and the importance and value of making sure that we rest and we take time away to restore ourselves. And that was also really valuable. The students do such mind-blowing work.
I think when it comes to PTO, also read an article about the guilt of unlimited PTO. Some companies have started implementing it a few years ago, and a lot of people don't know what's okay and what's not okay. And the study showed how the US is different from a lot of the European countries, as well as the UK, where in Europe and the UK, people were a lot more open to be taking time off and, capitalizing on that opportunity, spending time with family and traveling. Whereas in US, people felt guilty, and they thought that if they take time off, somebody else is going to overcome them, especially when it comes to women. The research showed that there is just no desire, not even not desire, but no, not an opportunity to take that time off without feeling the pressure. And whether or not you're, a mother or a single woman, it doesn't matter. They all feel that same type of just pressure when it comes to workplace. And among some of the younger generations, looking at the hybrid model, kids that went to college throughout COVID, and the ones that have graduated high school and now are in college, they have really struggled trying to find, that perfect balance between, do we work and start remotely? How do we go into office? How do we socialize? And I think not many people talk about both the younger talent in sports as well as the folks coming into academia or corporate. How does the lack of human interaction that we've had during the pandemic impacted one's ability to communicate and grow a career in a now more of a hybrid or in office policies, right? And would you say that some of your students are easily adaptable to the new changes, or the majority still prefer being remote?
I feel like I don't have a good gauge on our students specifically because we have a on-campus cohort who have chosen to be in person on campus because they prefer it. One of the things I can say from going through the research on the topic is that the findings around like feelings of isolation specifically are very strong. When people are not at work together, they do tend to feel more isolated. And that's why it's so important to create that sense of connection. That said, the flexibility of being able to have like a hybrid or remote schedule far outweighs the negatives of that isolation. So most people are like, I'll deal with the isolation if it means that I can like take care of my elderly family member or my child or, you know, things like that. There was something else I was going to add here, but you know, there's the isolation and there is the inability to network. So when you talk about careers, when you're not in person, you too as an individual have to be more proactive in networking. One of the things that we know, for example, helps women to advance in workplaces is having a sponsor, having someone who's willing to advocate for you and help you to move up the ranks. And it's really hard to do that if people don't know you. And it's very easy to have your work be less visible when you're working remotely or working in a hybrid model. So, one, you have to be really good at keeping your manager and others abreast of the work that you're doing, making your work really visible, and also being really intentional about continuing to get to know people, to network, et cetera, even when you're not with them in person.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think I also was a victim of isolation, back in during COVID, for example, when I was pursuing my degree, but I was abroad and I was, working the Pacific hours, which were, I had to stay up for half the night to attend lectures, and I think that made me feel very isolated. And then coming back to finish my senior year, of course, it was such a different experience, and I struggled to communicate to the same level that I could before COVID and feeling that isolation. So, last question, if I may, if you had to give three tips to a leader or a CEO or someone, a coach perhaps, for developing a successful team. Either someone that are just starting out or trying to rebuild an existing team, what would those three tips be?
I would say hire intentionally for what it is that you really need. Build psychological safety so that everyone feels they can contribute. Oftentimes, the biggest mistakes that are made on teams stem from a lack of safety, being able to share. So, Amy Edmondson is the person who created this concept of psychological safety, and she, in her book, The Fearless Organization talks about how massive organizational catastrophes have occurred as a result of people not feeling safe enough to point out a mistake. So, as a leader, it's really important to create those safe spaces where it's not all you making decisions, it's not all you deciding on the path forward, but really creating spaces where people can contribute, fully show up as themselves. Because that's engaging. When we can play to our strengths, it can be very engaging and contribute, even if we are pointing out a mistake. And there are some ways that we can do that, which, if you'd like, we can get into further detail around. But creating that psychological safety and holding people to a high standard so that they can work their way up to it with this kind of underpinning of psychological safety and trust can be a really powerful thing.
Thank you so much. Everything you've shared today has been super useful. And on behalf of SCI, myself and the colleagues would like to thank you for sharing your wisdom. And I'm sure our listeners will have a great time learning more about the tips and tricks of organizational psychology and how to build something that is gonna create impact and be long lasting with happy people in the organization. So thank you so much, Mona. We hope you have a wonderful New Year's celebration tomorrow. And once again, thank you.
Thank you.